Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Gelton, and this is On Point. Yesterday, President Trump announced his administration's national security strategy. He said we live in a new world of great power rivalries with new enemies and new threats. He promises to make America great again by putting America first and fighting with new vigor and determination. This hour on Point, the Trump administration's national security strategy. You can join us on air or online. Does the president's tough talk give you confidence? Does an America First strategy make sense for the country? What do you think should be our national security priorities? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook. In his speech summarizing his national security strategy yesterday, President Trump described a more competitive world in which America should act with less idealism and more realism.
Our new strategy is based on a principled realism, guided by our vital national interests and rooted in our timeless values. This strategy recognizes that whether we like it or not, we are engaged in a new era of competition. We accept that vigorous military, economic, and political contests are now playing out all around the world.
And joining me now from Washington is Dmitry Savastopoulos. He's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. Dmitry, thanks for joining me here on Point.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
So, Dmitry, that little bit there from the speech sounded actually pretty typical for our president's national security strategy. And yet other parts of his speech made it seemed almost as if he was at a campaign rally. What's your sense of how much of this speech was sort of crafted by the president's national security advisors, and how much was reflected the president's own personal thinking?
Well, I think if you landed on Earth from Mars and read the document, you wouldn't necessarily at first glance associate it with Donald Trump if you saw or listened to what he had said during campaign rallies. But when you read it carefully, you realize that it's an attempt to essentially take what's a kind of a standard national security document that all administrations have to do under law and fuse it with some of the America First ideas that Donald Trump repeatedly mentioned on the campaign, whether it's China raping America or things like that. I mean, the document tries to kind of thread the needle and fuse those two things together. It does it in a way that I think is in some ways a much more polite version of what we heard in January when the president delivered his what's called the American Carnage inauguration speech. But it's pretty clear that, you know, the things that he talks about in this document are very heavily weighted towards rebalancing the global economy, fixing things that have been allowed to break over the years and have been unfair to America. There's a strong emphasis on immigration, protecting the borders, homeland security. As you mentioned at the top, there's less focus on kind of promoting American ideals around the world. So I think overall, it's very clearly President Trump's document. He's the first president, I think, who's actually gone out and made a speech when the document has been released. And the speech itself, as you said, it's almost slightly Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, in that you had a kind of a lot of campaign rhetoric talking about the stock market and how great he had done and things were tremendous, then bolstered with this talk about how he can make America great again by doing these things that are outlined in this national security strategy.
Well, Dmitry, you've covered other national security strategy rollouts. What are some of the points in President Trump's strategy that really strike you as a departure from what you've seen and heard before from previous White Houses?
Well, I think the two main things are, first, as I just said, there's a much stronger focus on economic issues. There's a line in there where they say that the U.S. is no longer going to allow other countries to get away with economic aggression. And while they don't specifically say that that is targeted at China, it's throughout the report, the country that gets the most criticism by far is China, with Russia running in second place. I think that leads into the second main difference, is that there is a very, very big emphasis on China and Russia in this document. If you look back from President Clinton onwards, I think this is probably the toughest language we've seen on China in a document like this. And George W. Bush, when he campaigned in 2000, he criticized Clinton for having saying that China was a strategic partner. And yet, when he wrote his first national security strategy, which was 2002, after the 9/11 attacks, the tone on China was much softer. And in his second NSS, it was similar. And Barack Obama produced two of these documents. They were also much, much softer on China. And they talked about the kind of incredible partnerships that the US and China had developed on everything from climate change to, I think, to doing things in Afghanistan and other areas. So you see that we've, it's a little bit kind of going back in history here to an approach on China that you haven't seen in a document like this. And I think we've had an interesting year where Donald Trump came to office talking very harshly about China on the campaign trail. I mean, he did use the word at one point saying China had raped the US. And yet this year, he's taken very little action to address what he sees the problems in the relationship to be. That's partly because the US wants China to help more to tackle the nuclear crisis on the Korean Peninsula. But it's also because there have been problems within his administration trying to work out, how do you take certain actions against China in a way that don't breach international rules yourself, so that you're then, you know, further breaking the system that you say has been allowed to break over the last decade or two.
Okay, we're going to get back to that discussion about China, also the references to Russia in there. But before we go on, let's listen to a couple more clips from the president's speech. Here is one where he is not talking so much about national security as about how and why he got elected.
When the American people speak, all of us should listen. And just over 1 year ago, you spoke loud and you spoke clear. On November 8th, 2016, you voted to make America great again.
And the president, as we said, described the underlying theme of his strategy as one of principled realism. But in doing that, he recalled his campaign slogan, America First.
Upon my inauguration, I announced that the United States would return to a simple principle. The first duty of our government is to serve its citizens, many of whom have been forgotten. But they are not forgotten anymore. With every decision and every action, we are now putting America first.
And joining us now from New York is Richard Haass. He is the president of the Council on Foreign Relations. Before that, he was a U.S. diplomat serving under Presidents Carter, Reagan, and both President Bushes. He's worked at the Pentagon, the White House, the State Department. There, he was director of policy planning. His latest book, A World in Disarray, is coming out in paperback on January 2nd. Ambassador Haass, it's a real pleasure to have you with us here on Point.
Thank you, Tom.
And, you know, your new book is called A World in Disarray, but I want to go back to one of your previous books. Foreign Policy Begins at Home was the title. And in that book, Ambassador Haass, you laid out some themes, some messages that actually seemed to be very consistent with what President Trump laid out yesterday. How do you see his emphasis on putting America first against your own message in the past of foreign policy begins at home?
I could see why you'd say that, Tom, but you know, the big difference between me and the president, I think, is twofold here. One is foreign policy may begin at home, that our role in the world needs to rest on a foundation of a strong economy, a united society, but foreign policy doesn't end at home. There's got to be a large American role in the world. The United States has to, I would argue, stay as the leader in forging coalitions and building institutions to deal with regional and global challenges. And despite the rhetoric in yesterday's statement about the United States being committed to doing that, the reality is we're not. Second of all, when it comes to some of the specifics of this administration's domestic policy, I actually think it's undermining our foundations. The tax bill that's going to be passed today will increase the debt over the next decade by approximately $2 trillion. That makes us more, not less, vulnerable and it makes us less competitive. The opposition to significant immigration, I think, removes a real engine of innovation in our society. I think the crowding out of spending on domestic programs, discretionary domestic programs, will over time make us much less competitive. So I could go down the list. So, in principle, again, I think that we need a strong economy, a strong society. But what worries me is that many of the things this administration is doing, I think, will have the opposite effect.
Now, he did mention, once again, as he has many times before, the need for massive investments, new investments in infrastructure, which, again, is mm-hmm. a theme that you have emphasized.
Absolutely, and I'd love to see it. It's one of the reasons that I think some of the tax cut we're about to pass goes too far. But sure, we need infrastructure. Indeed, if I had been arguing over the legislative calendar, I would have said put that up front. That ought to have been something that Republicans and Democrats could have agreed on. It would have made us more competitive. It would have put more people to work, would have made us more resilient in the face of natural disasters or terrorism. So there are any number of reasons for the United States to do infrastructure, including the fact that so much of our infrastructure, as you know, whether it's our roads, our bridges, our rail, is significantly out of date.
Now, Richard, you've worked at the White House. You've been a part, I'm sure, of the preparation of previous national security strategies.
Yes, sir.
Same question for you that I posed to Dmitry earlier. When you listened to that speech, how much of it do you think reflected sort of the professional thinking of his national security team versus, the president just sort of going off on his own?
I think it mainly reflected the interagency process, the security team. I've drafted these and I've had my drafts largely rejected. So I know something about the process. And usually presidents get involved only towards the end. So my guess is this represents something of an interagency consensus. I'm told the principals, the National Security Advisor, the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, and others played a large role in it. But my guess is the president's role was pretty modest. And again, I think the lead story out of this is the gap between the document and his own foreign policy.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Tom Gelton. We're digging into President Trump's new national security strategy. He sees it as a way to move the country forward in a dangerous world. You can join the conversation. Do you agree with this administration that we've entered a kind of new Cold War? Is the president right on China, on Russia? Speaking of Russia and China, here's what the president had to say about China and Russia.
We also face rival powers, Russia and China, that seek to challenge American influence, values, and wealth. We will attempt to build a great partnership with those and other countries, but in a manner that always protects our national interest.
And my guests on this program so far are Dmitry Sevastopulo, Washington Bureau Chief of the Financial Times, and Richard Haass, President of the Council on Foreign Relations. And Richard, Dmitry earlier really emphasized President Trump said about China as being sort of a new departure from sort of conventional thinking. I'm wondering, before we get to Russia, what were your thoughts on the way that President Trump talked about the relationship with China and the threat that it presents?
Well, that to me was substantively, Tom, the most striking part of the document. And I agree with Dmitry there 100%. It actually represented a big idea. He talks about the challenge the two of them are posing. And then he talks about these competitions require the U.S., the United States, to rethink the policy of the last two decades, policies based on the assumption that engagement with rivals – and their inclusion in international institutions and commerce would turn them into benign actors and trustworthy partners. And then he goes on to say this premise turned out to be false. And even though the way it was characterized in the document was an overstatement and a bit of a red herring, I think the point's a big one, that he's essentially saying that great power rivalry, which was muted for a generation with the end of the Cold War, has now come back in full force. I think it's pretty true when it comes to Russia. I think it's more nuanced with China. But I think it's an interesting statement, in part because it's totally at variance with his own statements and policies since he's become president. But also, if people really believe that, then what then? If we're essentially saying that we're going back to great power competition, that becomes the basis of what goes on in the world. What actually does it mean for how do we deal with regional and global challenges? Do we give up on the idea of bringing Russia and China into arrangements to deal with the North Koreas or the Irans or the Pakistans or climate change or how to regulate cyberspace? If they really believe that, then that is a major departure in American foreign policy. And again, I'm a little bit hard-pressed to know exactly how seriously to take all this.
Yeah, because as you say, on the one hand, President Trump seems attracted to great powers, and yet he's emphasizing great power rivalry here. There is a bit of a contradiction there. Let's turn now to Russia, the other great power. And again, sort of a confusing mix of messages here. In his speech, or rather in his national security strategy, President Trump said that Russia is interfering in the domestic political affairs of countries around the world. He says a democracy is only as resilient as its people. An informed and engaged citizenry is the fundamental requirement for a free and resilient nation. And yet actors such as Russia are using information tools in an attempt to undermine the legitimacy of democracies. Dmitry Sevastopoulos, how do you read between the lines here? I mean, is President Trump really intent on taking on Russia as a threat, or is he more interested, as he has been up till now, it seems, in sort of working with the Russians?
Well, they're not necessarily mutually exclusive, but I think what's interesting is that President Trump, you know, since before he was inaugurated and since, has really gone out of his way to resist saying that Russia interfered in the U.S. election, because he doesn't want people to think that his victory was dependent on Russian help. So he's very resistant when people say that. And there was a very interesting story, I think it was the New York Times, but I could be wrong, recently, where they talked about how when people brief Donald Trump on national security issues, they tend to kind of push aside or downplay some of the Russia interference lines because they don't want him to get upset. So the document is interesting. As you said, it talks about, you know, Russia wanting to shape a world that's antithetical to U.S. values and interests. It talks about Russia interfering in the domestic political affairs of countries around the world. It says Russia uses information operations as part of an offensive cyber effort to influence public opinion. And that's clearly the view of the U.S. intelligence community, which also thinks that Russia interfered in the U.S. election. But nowhere in the document does it talk about Russia doing that with respect to America. So again, this is an attempt to thread the needle between something that almost everyone in the interagency process, with maybe a few small exceptions, believes to be the case, but doing it in a way that Donald Trump is not going to stand up the next day and have to answer questions about Russian interference. And as you say, I mean, since he came to power, he has clearly decided that making amends with Russia and trying to develop a better relationship with Vladimir Putin than Barack Obama had is one of his goals. But he's been hampered in doing that partly because of the Russia investigation back here in the U.S. and also because Congress has taken actions that have made it more difficult for Donald Trump to do some of the things on Russia mm-hmm. that he wanted to do, including potentially lifting or weakening some of the sanctions that were slapped on Russia because of its actions in Ukraine and the Crimea.
Here's what one of our listeners, Rob O'Keefe, thinks. He says, Russia, a rival power? Well, if you consider their nukes and Putin's ego, maybe, but that's about it. I'm sure he doesn't want to hurt Putin's feelings, so treat him like a rival, I guess, like a rival as opposed to a threat. Again, Richard Haass, your reaction to this kind of mixed message about Russia and what it means for the U.S. going forward?
Well, the document was pretty tough. And in a funny sort of way, the document was the mirror image, I think, of what Putin would say. because Putin has given up on the idea of integration in Western institutions. He sees the world as hostile to him, trying to essentially remove him from power. So the document was the American equivalent of that, saying Russia is an outlier and we've got to push back against them wherever they threaten us. And I actually think that's probably more right than not. Again, the problem for the president is it's totally at variance with his own refusal to recognize what Russia has done. He sees, and indeed it's the great mystery, Tom, as you know, as Dmitry knows, of this administration for its entire life and even for the year before. This president and those around them have taken a benign or sanguine view of everything Russia does, of everything Mr. Putin does. And this document is interesting, but in part because of the gap between it and this president, who also, by the way, sees foreign policy much more in terms of personal relationships than he does in terms of policies or interests. And I think in his view, he would feel that whatever chemistry, quote unquote, he has with somebody like Vladimir Putin, or for that matter, Xi Jinping, can offset any differences in objective policies or interests.
Let's bring another voice into this conversation now. Elon Berman is senior vice president at the American Foreign Policy Council. He reviewed parts of the national security strategy while it was being crafted, and he attended the president's speech yesterday. He's in Washington. Elon, thanks for joining us here on Point.
Oh, good to be here, Tom.
So one of the things that you've heard, if you've been following this conversation so far, is this notion of a gap between maybe what the national security establishment, even including the president's own national security advisors, believe and argue for and advocate, and what the president himself says, leading to some sort of confusion about what the bottom line is. What's your sense of, you know, sort of the coherence issue of the president's speech?
Well, that's certainly a major factor, and in the professional national security establishment that surrounds this administration, there has been for a long time an effort to try to draw out foundational principles, guiding principles, do so both for coherence in terms of the way the administration approaches the world, Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, but also in terms of putting down markers, putting down benchmarks that will then empower ancillary strategies, because it's useful to remember what the national security strategy is actually intended to be. This is intended to be an umbrella, an articulation of principles that under which will come other strategies, sub-strategies, strategies dealing with national counterterrorism policy, national defense policy. Those strategies have yet to be crafted. There are certainly ideas about what they should include. But until we had this document, the document that the president unveiled yesterday, what we really were lacking was this sort of set of operational principles that would empower this sort of coherence on these other levels as well.
But Elon, we've seen, in commentary on this, some concerns about what message foreign governments will take from this speech. The Washington Post this morning is quoting a professor of international relations in Beijing is saying, what is the strategy after all? It's not clear. Is there a danger here that foreign governments might be confused, you know, by this kind of multiplicity of emphases and messages?
So the answer is yes and no. Certainly, the president's speech was, a full-throated articulation of the principles that he believes underpin his foreign policy. But foreign observers, when they look at this strategy and they don't read till the end, because most of them won't, may have this confusion. This is a long document. It's roughly 80 or so pages. But the most important part, at least sort of for my money, is the last quarter of the national security strategy, because one thing that the framers did very well was to take these broad principles and to put them in regional context. There's actually a section called the strategy in regional context, and it lays down markers about what the administration thinks it's important to do in various global regions, in the Middle East, in Asia, in Europe. This is, I think, a very good benchmark against which the president's foreign policy is going to be measured or should be measured moving forward, because for people who are looking at the strategy holistically, they may have some problem translating these ideas into concrete strategies. I think the folks in the national security establishment that framed this document anticipated that, and so they've actually provided a roadmap.
And you're, for the most part, pleased, satisfied with the way he laid it out?
For the most part, right? The only national security strategy I would be 100% comfortable with would be my own. But, you know, that being said, I think this is, on balance, a fairly robust articulation of a couple of things that I think are very important. First of all, in his speech yesterday unveiling the strategy, the president articulated a number of things that folks in the national security establishment have been grappling with for a long time under the Obama administration. The need to reverse the inadequacy of resources for the U.S. military, for example, the lack of a clear mission of what the United States is actually trying to do in places like the Middle East, and the need to prod American allies abroad to take a bigger chunk of burden sharing with regard to not only NATO, but also foreign deployment and peacekeeping. Yeah. And these are all things I think that are captured very well in the strategy. But it's also necessary to point out what the strategy isn't. The strategy is about America first, but it's not really about America alone. This isn't an isolationist strategy. This is a pretty robust defense of American engagement with the world, but only on America's terms.
Okay. That's Elon Berman. He's Senior Vice President of the American Foreign Policy Council. I'm Tom Gjelten. This is On Point. Another theme that came up several times in this speech yesterday was the importance of the economy as a key part of national security. Here's President Trump again.
For the first time, American strategy recognizes that economic security is national security. Economic vitality, growth, and prosperity at home is absolutely necessary for American power and influence abroad.
Ambassador Richard Haass at the Council on Foreign Relations, he says this is the first time that American strategy recognizes that economic security is national security. But I recall, every year the intelligence community comes out with an assessment of global threats to U.S. security. And back in 2009, the intelligence community said the number one security concern of the United States is the global economic crisis. So it's not quite true that economic security and national security have never been linked before, right?
Exactly. And even more important, Tom, it's the way the president interprets it that to me, it gives me pause. He's a protectionist. And the fact that the United States unilaterally pulled itself out of what was to become the Trans-Pacific Partnership makes no trade or economic sense. As an aside, I would also say it weakened us. It was a form of unilateral disarmament against China's push for regional influence. It's not quite clear what we're going to be doing about NAFTA or the World Trade Organization. But all this just seems to ignore the fact that trade has been a major engine of economic growth in this country, that more than 10 million American jobs depend upon exports. I'm not saying the global trading regime is perfect. It needs to be fixed. But as is always the case, it's easier to fix as a participant than as an outside critic. And most of the job loss we're seeing in any case isn't coming from trade. It's coming from productivity increases tied to innovation, to robotics, artificial intelligence. It's going to come from driverless vehicles. And there's nothing in here that prepares us for this. And as we talked about before, I think the tax cut, while part of it I like, at least in principle, goes too far when it comes, say, to corporate tax reductions, but the increase in the deficit will crowd out investment, and it will make us much more vulnerable, among other things, to China, which is one of the two largest holders of American debt.
And you made the point before that you also think that immigration is a problem, is sort of a straw man. Let's go sneak in one caller, Eric from Boston, Massachusetts. Eric, what are your thoughts about the president's national security strategy?
Yeah. Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on. Real quick, and I don't know if any of you guys share this view, but when in terms of China, with how the president has pulled out of all these agreements like NAFTA, the Paris Climate Agreement, I kind of see him pushing them into that global leader role as opposed to strengthening us. He's kind of bailing on all these global agreements, and I just see him kind of pushing these other countries such as China into power, kind of contradicting himself. So I'll leave you with that.
Okay.
And thank you.
All right, Eric. Dimitri, you want to take that on? This is sort of going back to a theme you mentioned at the top of the program.
Sure. Well, I mean, some of the things that President Trump is doing, whether it's pulling out of the TPP, as Richard mentioned, pulling out of the Paris Accord on climate change, when actually the U.S. could have accomplished his goals without doing so, are creating a vacuum that around the world, in some places, people are worrying about China taking a leadership role in places where it would not be in the U.S. interest for that to happen. And, you know, Eric talked about this. The really interesting illustration of this is Xi Jinping at Davos this year, and also once again in Da Nang at the APEC summit last month, which I was at. He basically gave a kind of a global vision of the world that the U.S. leader would normally give, whereas Donald Trump gave what some people would say was a very protectionist speech. So you're seeing, at least in terms of the optics, a very different picture on the world stage this year.
This is On Point. I'm Tom Gjelten. We're talking about President Trump's national security strategy. You can join the conversation. How do you think world leaders are reacting to the president's speech yesterday, especially in Moscow, Beijing, Iran, North Korea? My guests are Richard Haass, president of the Council on Foreign Relations, and Ilan Berman, senior vice president of the American Foreign Policy Council, and Dmitry Sevastopoulos, Washington bureau chief for the Financial Times. But before we get back into the discussion, one more excerpt from the president's speech yesterday. This was one of the more specific policy prescriptions in the speech, the call for a massive buildup of the U.S. military. Here's the president on that.
It calls for a total modernization of our military and reversing previous decisions to shrink our armed forces, even as threats to national security grew. It calls for streamlining acquisition, eliminating bloated bureaucracy, and massively building up our military, which has the fundamental side benefit of creating millions and millions of jobs.
Ilan Berman, he went on to say that he wants to get rid of the sequester, which limited military spending in the interests of keeping the deficit down. When you talk about a massive buildup of the military, that certainly doesn't suggest much sensitivity to the issue of the impact on the deficit. How do you assess that?
No, I think that's right. One of the major criticisms of the defense sequester so far has been that it's sort of a blunt instrument. It's a top-line cut on a number of vital programs in the U.S. military, and it's left the U.S. military, in addition to having less resources, less agile, less nimble, less able to respond to global events. So this was a speech where that nuance was sort of not captured. But in the document itself, I think there's a pretty compelling theme woven throughout about the need for sort of a persistent presence from the United States in various parts of the world, in the Middle East, in Asia. That can only be accomplished through greater capitalization of military forces that allow them to forward deploy quicker, faster, more nimbly, in a way that the president sees as sort of a vital component of this pillar that he talks about, this peace through strength.
But I'm wondering whether that can be accomplished without going backward a little bit in terms of the fiscal effort. I'm reminded of what Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said back in 2009. He said, the national debt threatens our way of life. It threatens the value of our national currency. It endangers our position in the world, the long-term capabilities of our military, and the long-term viability of the all-volunteer force. Richard Haass. And I also remember Mike Mullen, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, saying that he thought that the national debt is the biggest threat to the country. What do you make of this apparent retreat, Richard, from the urgency that was previously attached to national debt as an issue?
It's extremely unfortunate, and it will come back to bite us. It will crowd out all sorts of funding. We're going to basically have a budget in a few years that's going to consist of servicing the debt, and entitlements and military, and we're going to have very little left for anything else. Look, I think there's a decent case, though, to be made that we need to spend a little bit more in the military. We face an enormous number and range of threats, including things like North Korea and all that could mean, as well as challenging or meeting the challenge of Iran, as well as counterterrorism and counter ISIS and counter Al Qaeda. So it's a very full thing. Anyway, that said, it's always more important how you spend the money than how much you spend. And one other thing, I guess two other things. One is I'm more worried about entitlements driving our debt than an extra 10 or 20 billion in military spending. Also, Tom, if I were going to spend a little bit more on national security, to me, it's a no-brainer. I'd spend it on diplomacy and the State Department. That's where we're gutting the budget. And I think every military person I know would say right now, if you have a spare dollar in your wallet, put it into diplomacy. And the military has to gets called on disproportionately if diplomacy fails. So the cuts that Rex Tillerson and this administration are making to the State Department and diplomacy truly fall into the penny-wise, pound-foolish department. And that's where we're really bleeding our national security capability.
Well, as someone who worked there, you would know. I want to bring some callers back, some listeners back into a conversation. First, we're going to go to Jim. He's on the line from Rockport, Maine. Hello, Jim. Thanks for calling On Point.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
Good. Your thoughts.
I appreciate Mr. Ha's comments, but could I was going to lead with something else, but the deficit of which he spoke so eloquently a minute ago, his voice would have been welcome when the last administration blew a hole in the budget and doubled our debt with seemingly not a single word from the establishment. But my major point, I think, is that Mr. Trump's policy yesterday, there's lots of things that disagree with Mr. Trump on, but I think this injects a little bit of realism back into the discussion because, frankly, the Chinese military buildup is made in America. They're selling us all kinds of trinkets, and they're coming back in the form of warships and aircraft. And then furthermore, you know, I think his budget, his priorities of putting America first, I think Americans are tired of seeing their young men and women go off to countries for less than what seem to be realistic goals. And we squander our blood and our treasure to help Iran. So I'd appreciate your comments.
Well, first of all, I'm going to answer on behalf of Ambassador Haas here. First of all, I know that he raised the issue of the debt as a problem for America, even during the past administration. So I'm just going to answer that on his behalf.
Thank you, Tom.
But I want to go to Dimitri here, and I want you to get your reaction to Jim's point that, you know, it makes sense to tackle China from a trade point of view. That, you know, this China, and I think Jim would agree with President Trump that China has been sort of ripping us off.
Well, I think there's been a sea change in the view in the U.S. towards China. I left Washington in 2009 and went to Hong Kong and China for 6 years. When I left, the U.S. business community was always encouraging the administration to tamp down criticisms because they saw such a market potential in China. When I came back in 2015, I was surprised to see that most businesses were actually urging the Obama administration to be much tougher on China, on things like market access, on things like protecting intellectual property. When you look at the national security strategy yesterday, there's a couple of interesting things in there talking about trying to protect the American defense industrial base. But also there's a line which is a little bit vague but says the U.S. reserves the right to adjust its visa policies essentially to make it more difficult for students from designated countries to study STEM, so science, technology, engineering, and math. Now, I think that's probably largely directed at China. So I think the view in Washington is changing. I think Donald Trump sometimes, uses rhetoric that some people would say is too harsh or is counterproductive. But certainly there is a feeling that China has been able to do things that the U.S. hasn't been able to counter as strongly as it should do.
You know, a couple of our listeners agree with some of what President Trump has argued. Dev, for example, says Ukraine and Crimea are not U.S. problems. Let those Slavic countries deal with their own blood and brethren. Well, President Trump didn't talk specifically about Ukraine and Crimea, but he did criticize sort of the overextension of U.S. efforts overseas. Also, Nelson writes, any national security doctrine has to include a total rejection of globalism and the the role of world policeman for the USA. We've been fighting someone somewhere since December 7th, 1941, bring the troops home, and force the UN to do their job to keep the peace where possible and accept the reality that we can't police the world. Elon Berman, again, sort of a little, some mixed messages in what President Trump said. On the one hand, he really applauded and endorsed the expanded U.S. effort against ISIS and took some credit for promoting that. And yet, he also said that the U.S. is overextended and we can't play policeman around the world. How do you see President Trump's national security strategy with respect to the projection of U.S. power abroad?
Right. Well, no, I think this is a key issue. And I think the proper way to think about this strategy is that it's a middle way between the idealism that animated the Bush administration in terms of engagement abroad, democracy promotion, things like that, and the multilateralism and, frankly, the disengagement that empowered the Obama administration. He talks a lot about this isn't an isolationist document, as I said. This is he talks a lot about engagement, but he talks about competitive engagement. Competing in the economic sphere, in the political sphere with hostile powers, which he identifies not only as rogue states like Iran and North Korea, but also he said in his speech, he talked about rival powers, Russia and China. In the document itself, it actually refers to them as revisionist powers, which is, I think, a very different classification. And it tees up a larger, deeper conversation about the proper role that the U.S. should play counterbalancing these forces. But listen, this is a middle way. It's a middle way that envisions empowering those partners in various regions that share our values and share our principles, but also compelling those countries to do more for the common defense. I think that's a pretty robust and a pretty sustainable argument.
Let's go now to Sally, who's on the line from Waterville, Vermont. Sally, your thoughts on the president's national security strategy.
Hello, and thanks, Tom. Nice that On Point continues. First of all, I'd like to point out that we did not speak loud and clear last year on November 8th. It was a very short margin of victory and not a carte blanche. The other thing is I'm really incredulous that talking about national security, that climate change wasn't mentioned. We've just heard the figures coming in on the budget for taking care of hurricane, flooding, forest fires, not to mention the Americans that are living in Puerto Rico. I know that Donald is familiar with resurrecting from bankruptcy, but I just don't see that we have the money to avoid dealing with our part that we should play on the globe.
Well, that is an important point. We haven't mentioned that the president's speech didn't mention climate change. I'm Tom Gelton. This is On Point. And Dimitri, that was, of course, one of the early headlines about this speech, that it seemed to sort of really drop. I mean, climate change had been mentioned as a national security threat in previous national security strategies, not in this one.
No, that's correct. I mean, I don't think it was a surprise, given that Donald Trump pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Accord. I mean, the document does talk about climate, but what it says is that talks about countering anti-growth energy agenda that are detrimental to U.S. interests, and that then it talks about the U.S. being self-sufficient in terms of energy. So it looks at the energy issue from a different angle, but certainly the idea that climate change is a national security risk, which is something, frankly, that is a consensus view among the leadership in the Pentagon and the national security establishment, has been dropped completely.
Yeah. Let's go now to Sandra, who's on the line from Kingston, Ontario. Sandra, what's the view from Canada?
Hi, Tom. Can you hear me?
I sure can. Go ahead.
Thank you so much for having me. Tom, no, I guess, yes, we're seeing this from a little bit further away in Canada. I also have family in New Zealand and Kuala Lumpur. And I think from our point of view, many people's point of view, your president has lost all credibility on the world stage. He's viewed from afar by many people as a bully, as a narcissist, and as a malignant narcissist, and really sort of as a sexual predator. He has admitted this. So we are tired, I guess, of hearing discussions trying to make sense of what he's saying, because there it does seem from afar as just completely nonsensical.
Okay.
And people are starting to tune out.
Well, that issue of U.S. standing in the world is a really important one. Richard Haass, you know, was it just yesterday the U.N. Security Council voted to in disapproval of the president's determination to move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem and make Jerusalem recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital? It was the U.S. had to veto that. Every single country in the Security Council took an opposite stand. What's your sense of the U.S. position in the world right now? Is the U.S. regaining global respect, like President Trump says we are, or are we losing credibility, like our caller from Canada thinks?
Alas, it's closer to the caller for two reasons. One is taking a range of international positions, which are just making us the odd man out. One you just alluded to, which is the position on recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital, the position on climate change, pulling us out of climate, pulling us out of TPP. We boycotted the international migration meeting the other day in Mexico. So we've gone a long way from the United States being the principal advocate and promoter of international efforts to deal with regional and global challengers, and now we're essentially sitting it out. So that's a fundamental change in our relationship with the rest of the world. And then secondly, Tom, everything we are, everything we do, everything we say here at home has a foreign policy impact. People see us for what we are. So whether it's Charlottesville or the inequality in the society or political dysfunction, you name it, the president's tweets and statements and the rest, people see us. And I think we've come a long way from a shining city on a hill where our example was a powerful source of American influence. I think increasingly the example we're setting is alienating more than it is inspiring.
And I want to give you, Ilan Berman, a final thought on that same question, U.S. standing in the world.
Look, so I think there are legitimate concerns about American consistency, about the message and the messenger. I do have to say that I think actions speak a lot louder than words. And in various theaters, in particular on issues like combating the Islamic State, on issues like sort of moving robustly against Iranian influence in the Middle East, this is going to get proven out, I think, in terms of much more about what the administration does rather than what it says.
That's Ilan Berman. He's Senior Vice President of the American Foreign Policy Council. He joined us from Washington. Ilan, thanks very much for coming on.
My pleasure.
My other guests are Richard Haass. He's President of the Council on Foreign Relations, and he joined us from CFR Studios in New York. Richard, thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
And finally, Dimitri Sevastopulo, Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. And I think Dimitri was the first reporter to get a full version of that national security strategy. So congratulations, Dimitri, and thanks for coming on Point.
Thanks, Tom.
You can continue this conversation, and you can get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Gelton. This is On Point.